From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Jimmy Carter was the first president to tell the public that he was born again. But he says he always respected the wall between church and state. Now he's concerned that wall is eroding. He explains why in his new book, Our Endangered Values. On today's Fresh Air, we talk with him about his book and how he interpreted the separation of church and state when he was in office. Also, uncovering waste and fraud in the rebuilding of Iraq, we talk with Stuart Bowen, the Special Inspector General for Iraq Reconstruction. His office has recently released its 7th quarterly report to Congress. He'll share adventures in extreme auditing in a country that's still at war. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Jimmy Carter was the first American president to tell the public that he was born again, but he believes in the separation of church and state and is worried that the wall is eroding. In his new book, Our Endangered Values, he draws on his experiences as president and as a Baptist to explain his concerns about the intertwining of politics and religion. President Carter, welcome back to Fresh Air. Do you think the line between church and state has shifted since you were president?
Well, this separation of church and state, which Thomas Jefferson ordained as a wall between the two, has been severely breached in the last 15 or 20 years, and particularly in the last 5 years. So the answer is yes. When I was president, and I think all my predecessors and most of my successors have been meticulous in trying to separate church and state and not inject religious aspects into policy and not let the churches or any religion dominate or heavily influence the political decisions made by this government. So this is a radical departure from what we've seen in our country since its founding.
Are there times where you feel President Bush has eroded the line between church and state?
Yes, I don't think there's any doubt that the nation knows that President Bush, as president, strongly favors the religious right, Protestant Christians in our country. There's no doubt about this, in my opinion. But the religious part is not the most important. I think that's the background or the foundation for a lot of changes. But the major changes that concern me are more secular in nature. For instance, we have always had a policy in our country of peace. That is, that our country would not go to war and attack another country, bomb its people, invade that nation, unless our own security was directly threatened. That's been abandoned under this administration. And now the new policy is preemptive war, which the president declared at West Point, as you know, a couple of years ago. Our country now, because of its tremendous military might, reserves a right, publicly declared, to invade another country, to attack another country, to kill its citizens, not if our nation is security is endangered, but if we want to change the regime there for some reason. We've also abandoned our longstanding and admirable commitment to civil liberties and personal privacy of Americans and the protection of human rights around the world. This has not only been a matter of great pride to America, but it's also compatible with international law. And we now see a struggle within the Congress at this moment to permit the CIA, for instance, to torture prisoners. This is in direct violation of longstanding principles of our country, moral values, and also in direct violation of international agreements. So the radical change in America's domestic and international policies are what I'm trying to cover in saying that our endangered values are America's moral crisis and around the world.
You were the first president to say that you were born again. This was, and you said that during the election when you were asked by a reporter.
Yes.
After you proclaimed that you were born again, how did that change perceptions of you?
It was a very serious mistake for me to make. I was actually in the backyard of a friend in North Carolina, and I was asked, "Are you a born again Christian?" And I answered truthfully, "Yes, I am." I had always assume that that phrase was completely acceptable, at least among Christians. And there were news reporters there. It was kind of late in the 76 campaign, and it was reported, and the reaction was very severe and negative because the people who were not familiar with that phrase assumed that I was claiming to have some special endowment from God in visions, and that I also tended to elevate myself above all other human beings in my moral standards, which was not the case at all. Being a born-again Christian had been a phrase I used since I was probably 3 or 4 years old, as used regularly in Christian churches in my area. So it was a very negative reaction to what I had to say. And I was very careful from then on to separate openly and ostentatiously my religious faith from any responsibilities that I assumed when I became president.
How active do you think the Christian right was in 1976
They were non-existent.
Mm-hmm.
They were really non-existent then. There were a few statements made from some people that would now be called a Christian right, but they were insignificant. I think it was probably 3 or 4 years later before, I think, Time or Newsweek magazine, I've forgotten, had a front cover story on the birth of the Christian right. And in my own denomination, I was a Southern Baptist. It was the election of a president of a Southern Baptist Convention in 1979 that brought about a change in our own denomination. It took 10 years or so to completely implement what they espoused as fundamentalists. But it was not culminated until the year 2000. And at that time, a new doctrine was adopted in the Southern Baptist Convention like a creed, and that creed has now been imposed on Baptists. And, of course, Baptists have been non-creedal people since the founding of our faith many, many years ago. But those were the changes that have taken place.
When you were president, did you ever find that your political position and your religious views ever came into conflict?
Yes. There was one issue in particular that was a very serious problem for me, and that was abortion. I have never believed that Jesus Christ, whom I worship, would approve abortions unless the mother's health or life was threatened, or perhaps if the pregnancy was from rape or incest. This is hard for me to accept. And at the same time, I was sworn by oath to uphold the laws and Constitution of the United States as interpreted by the Supreme Court. And the Supreme Court had ruled that abortions in the first semester of pregnancy were completely acceptable. So I tried to do everything I could within the bounds of the law to minimize and discourage abortions. As a matter of fact, one of the easily understood principles is that two-thirds of the women who have abortions claim, at least, that the reason is that they cannot financially support another child. So I developed what's known as a Women Infant Children's Program, WIC program, to give special benefits to women and infant and pregnant women and infant children. Also, I promoted the proposition that adoption should be easier. And I tried to promulgate training for in high school on ways to avoid unwanted pregnancy. But I had to uphold the law. So that particular one was troublesome for me. Another that was legally troublesome for me that didn't really ever come into effect was the Supreme Court's ruling before I became president that authorized a death penalty. That had been prohibited as unfair. But when the Supreme Court ruled, luckily, I went through my entire term as governor and my entire term as president, and no one was executed under my administrations. And I have never felt that Jesus Christ, again, would approve the death penalty as it's presently supported so strongly by some of the conservative Christians and others in this country. Those are the two issues.
With abortion, since you personally oppose abortion but upheld a woman's right to abortion because the Supreme Court ensured that right, did you ever state your views on abortion? Did you feel like you should speak out against abortion as you continue to uphold the right to abortion?
Yes, I did frequently. As a matter of fact, I cover this in the book. On one occasion, I was questioned at one of my fairly frequent White House press conferences about the fact that rich women could buy abortions and that poor women didn't have a right to an abortion unless the federal government paid for them. And I made the remark that was somewhat criticized, and I can see why, that sometimes life is unfair. That's not a very good statement for a president to make. But that was the way I felt. I didn't think it was right for our country to support abortions by paying for abortions if it was just to end a pregnancy when the mother's life or safety was not endangered.
My guest is former President Jimmy Carter. His new book is called Our Endangered Values. We'll talk more after a break This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is President Jimmy Carter, and he's written a new book called Our Endangered Values, America's Moral Crisis. Now, you mentioned that when you publicly stated that you were born again when you were running for president, that it worked against you. People misunderstood what you meant by that, and you thought it hurt you in the election. It's funny because, you know, President Bush is born again. He discussed that when he was running for office, and, you know, it seemed to help him very much in his campaign. So would you reflect a little bit about what's changed?
Well, what's changed is what I described earlier. That is, the rise of fundamentalism has affected both politics, including national policy in domestic and foreign affairs, and also has affected the religious community much more than it ever did when I was in politics. And the two have now merged. So there is an ostentatious and very aggressive effort among the, you might say, the religious right leaders, and I don't criticize them because of their beliefs, publicly to align themselves with the Republican Party, provided the Republican Party members whom they support are adequately conservative. So that marriage has been a radical departure, in my opinion, from the ancient values of our country. At the same time, through various means, some of them not well publicized, there has been a tremendous amount of taxpayers' money that is being sent directed to churches in our country, and the argument has been, can the churches be discriminatory against people who receive services through them from taxpayers' money? And the present administration's policy is that we should not make the churches declare non-discrimination. Let them discriminate. So these two factors are unprecedented in our country, and I think they contravene the basic premises on which our country was founded, as espoused most clearly by Thomas Jefferson, who advocated a wall between church and state.
You're a Baptist, and you say in your book that Southern Baptists had been committed to the separation of church and state, and that the church abhorred the concept of churches becoming involved in the partisan world. And this is when you were growing up. Why was that there that rejection of getting involved in the political partisan world?
Well, when I was a little child, my father was a Sunday school teacher, and it was inculcated in me and the other students then that the basic origins of the Baptist Church in this country were for independence from government, and that we would not abide by government ordaining a particular denomination, a particular faith, or a particular church to be dominant, as had happened in Europe. In fact, that's why a lot of people came over. Roger Williams founded our church in this particular country. Also, the Baptists have always been a non-creedal organization, and that means that not only is every individual church congregation autonomous or sovereign, but that every individual human being has a right to go directly to God through prayer and to relate directly with God. So we avoided any sort of creed to be imposed on us by an outside power. And the Southern Baptist Convention itself has now departed from that, and in the year 2000, as I mentioned earlier, adopted a very severe creed that is now must be adopted officially by anyone who serves as a pastor in a church, who serves as a missionary overseas, who has a job as administrator or teacher in one of the Southern Baptist Convention's own seminaries to teach students, and so forth. So we have departed, I'm afraid, in many ways, from those religious policies.
You and Rosalind left the Southern Baptist Conference. Was it because of this new creed?
Yes, because of a new creed and some of the elements of it. Two things that I didn't mention that caused me concern was that in the old statements that Baptists used to use, very lax, it said that the interpretation of biblical verses, there are about more than 30,000 of them, would be for Christians the words and actions of Jesus Christ. That statement was deleted from a new creed. And instead, obviously in effect, the elected leaders of the Southern Baptist Convention would then be the interpreters of the Scripture, and that all subordinates, all people who adhere to that, had to agree. The other thing was their declaration concerning the subservience of women, that women have to be subservient to their husbands. And there now is a prohibition against any woman occupying a position of authority or responsibility within the Southern Baptist Convention. Our most famous and revered heroes when I was a child were people like Lottie Moon, who was a missionary to China. We still give a Lottie Moon Christmas offering throughout the Southern Baptist Convention. Now a woman can't be the lead missionary. A woman can't even be a chaplain, for instance, now in the military forces if she's a Southern Baptist. They have disavowed those policies, and a woman can't speak with authority or teach men in a church. Those are just a couple of the new ordained principles that all Southern Baptists now have to accept in order to be a member of the convention. I couldn't agree to that.
What about the church that you've belonged to in Plains, Georgia for so long, the church in which you've taught Sunday school for so many years? Are the members of that church still members of the Southern Baptist Convention?
I think, if I'm not mistaken, almost all of the members of our church agree with me and what I've just described to you as basic religious principles. What we call the sainthood of the believer, that is that each individual has a right to worship God directly, that each church has to be autonomous. We have women deacons, and next month we will ordain a woman minister in our church. She'll be the associate member of our church. And we believe that we shouldn't be bound by a creed imposed on us by outside. So the members of my church, still a Baptist church, have these same beliefs that I do, in effect. I can't say that everybody's 100% in agreement with me, but we have open discussions when our congregation gets together, and I think I'm accurately expressing the overwhelming beliefs.
My guest is President Jimmy Carter. He's written a new book called Our Endangered Values, America's Moral Crisis. Let me ask you about evolution, since, you know, intelligent design is before the courts now. How do you deal with the fact that science tells us different things than the Bible does about the creation of man and woman and the earth?
Well, in Our Endangered Values, the book, I describe my feelings about this quite thoroughly. I studied nuclear physics when I was a young man. I was one of the originators of a nuclear submarine program. I worked on Admiral Hyman Rickover. At the same time, as you've already mentioned, I'm a devout Christian. I don't see any incompatibility at all between the two. My belief is that God created the universe. My belief is that God permits us to understand the new developments that we can witness in universal matters. When the Bible was written, we didn't have the Hubble telescope. We didn't have microscopes so we could look at small items. We didn't have a way to test the age of rocks and so forth. And now we have these scientific capabilities. And so I think that science is just a revelation of God's creation. And so the two are completely separate, and we can't prove the existence of things in our faith. As a matter of fact, the definition of faith in the Bible is that we know things that cannot be proven. Well, we don't have to have faith to believe that the moon is out there. That's something that we can see for ourselves. And we can't have science prove the existence of God or all of the things that we know about Jesus Christ as a Christian. So the two are separate. I don't believe there's any place in a scientific classroom to try to prove to the students that God exists. I think the two ought to be completely separate. So I believe in both of them, the science and religion, the two are completely separate. One should not be imposed on the other.
Jimmy Carter's new book is called Our Endangered Values. We'll talk more in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air comes from Barnes & Noble, featuring Secrets of the Widow's Son by David Shugarts, a look at the upcoming sequel to The Da Vinci Code. Additional support for Fresh Air comes from Audible.com, where you can download and listen to NPR programs like Fresh Air, in addition to audiobooks, magazines, and newspapers, audible.com/fresh air. And from Image Entertainment, presenting Bill Maher, I'm Swiss. Political satirist Bill Maher takes a funny look at American life on DVD November 1st. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, investigating fraud, waste, and financial corruption in Iraq, we talk with Stuart Bowen, the Special Inspector General for Iraq Reconstruction, and we continue our discussion with former President Jimmy Carter. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with former President Jimmy Carter. He's written a new book called Our Endangered Values. He says the intertwining of politics and religion is breaching the wall between church and state. You write in your book that one of the most bizarre mixtures of religion and government is the strong influence of some Christian fundamentalists on U.S. policy in the Middle East. And you're referring there to Christians who believe in the rapture, that the second coming of Jesus is imminent, and that those who are born again will ascend to heaven when the second coming arrives, and everyone else will be left behind to face the tribulations. And Israel is important in this formula. What is Israel's place in this?
Well, what the people believe that you've just described is that Israel must take over the complete Holy Land, that is Gaza and all the West Bank, so that the Temple on the Mount, for instance, can be destroyed and the Temple of Israel be replace it, and other matters of that kind. And then in the end, when the rapture occurs, and the chosen people by God have been taken miraculously and instantaneously to heaven, and all the rest of us, or them, will be condemned to Hades, at that time, all the Jews, according to this principle, will either be converted to Christianity or burned. And so the ultimate goal of these people, the ultimate belief of these people, I'm sure they're very sincere and devout, is that, Judaism will be terminated completely, and that every Jew will have to be a Christian or have to die. Well, I think that, some of the Jewish leaders are willing to accept the proposition that, Jews take over the West Bank and, colonize the entire area of Palestinian land, but they don't look at the final premise on which this philosophy is based.
So, you're surprised that there are Israelis and Jewish American supporters who are forming alliances with the Christian right?
I'm not surprised.
Oh, okay.
I'm not surprised. I think that, they're willing to, take this financial help and this encouragement for some of the, more conservative Jewish leaders to, colonize the West Bank. And I think they just ignore as, a fallacy, an unproven premise, that ultimately they will suffer either death or have to become a Christian. I think they're ignoring the, ultimate consequence under the belief that it's probably not going to happen. But they're willing to take the immediate benefits.
After Hurricane Katrina destroyed some of the oil infrastructure along the Gulf Coast, President Bush made a speech in which he asked Americans to turn down their thermostats and carpool and do other things to conserve energy. Now, when you made your time to conserve energy speech when you were president, people mocked you for it. And in fact, some people thought it contributed to your losing your reelection campaign. Can you talk a little bit about that speech and what you were hoping to accomplish by giving it, and what your reaction was to the reaction you got after you gave it?
Well, I had to fight the oil crisis throughout my 4 years as president, and even when I was a governor, and President Richard Nixon was president, we had boycotts against the sale of oil to us because we were friendly toward Israel. And under President Nixon and under me, again, there were long lines at service stations waiting for gasoline. The last 12 months of my term, the price of oil skyrocketed, much greater increase than it has been in the last 12 months or so, because Iraq invaded Iran and all the oil from Iraq and Iran was terminated from the world supplies. So I was very seriously and adversely affected as an incumbent president, and so was our nation, by a sustained crisis concerning oil. My main thrust was to conserve oil, to conserve energy. And I worked out, just I'll give you one example to save time, with the Congress and with the oil companies, and primarily with automobile manufacturers, to require the increase of the efficiency of automobiles from 12 miles per gallon when I became president, and we established in the law an increase to 27.5 miles per gallon. When I went out of office, inadvertently and against my will, as you know, because of the 1980 election, that policy was basically terminated. And under President Reagan and his successors, the requirement for efficient automobiles has been lost. Now, of course, the big SUVs and Hummers and so forth don't come under any sort of restraints at all. And American motor vehicles use about 40% of our total oil, and we've become heavily dependent again on foreign oil. So that's what I had to struggle with, and that's what President Bush is addressing now. President Bush has not been willing to impose any kind of restraints on the efficiency of automobiles.
Let me get back to the speech. You wore a cardigan. Everybody always mentions that when they mention the speech. He was wearing a cardigan. You talked about the importance of turning down the thermostat and conserving
exactly.
energy. What did you think the reaction of the American public was going to be?
Well, as a matter of fact, if you look at the record, which I've done fairly often, in the 4 years, we were able to impose into law a profoundly important set of standards for efficiency, for insulation of homes, for the efficiency of stoves and refrigerators and other appliances, for electric motors used in industry, as well as the motor vehicles that I've described already to you. So despite the constant altercation about it, both Democrats and Republicans in the House and Senate approved my basic proposals, and we did implement those issues. So my hope and my expectation when I made this speech in my cardigan sweater were realized. And when I left office, there was a profoundly important set of laws imposed and rules imposed, and most of them have survived. The efficiency requirements for electric motors and refrigerator stoves and houses still exist without any attenuation. The basic change has been in motor vehicles, and that's where the present administration has backed away, as well as some of its predecessors.
Well, President Carter, I thank you for talking with us today. Thank you very much.
Terry, it's been a pleasure to be with you on Fresh Air again. It means a lot to me.
Jimmy Carter's new book is called Our Endangered Values. You can hear an excerpt of the audiobook version on our website, freshair.npr.org. Coming up, auditing the Iraq reconstruction and investigating fraud, bribery, and corruption. This is Fresh Air. It's not easy to do audits in a war zone, but that's the job of my guest, Stuart Bowen. As the Special Inspector General for Iraq Reconstruction, he oversees the auditing of the reconstruction and investigates American involvement in fraud, waste, bribery, and kickbacks in Iraq. He's based in Washington and is about to make his 10th trip to Iraq. Bowen was also the Inspector General for the Coalition Provisional Authority in Iraq. He's worked in the gubernatorial and presidential administrations of George W. Bush. Earlier this week, the Office of the Special Inspector General for Iraq Reconstruction, also known as SIGR, released its 7th report to Congress. Bowen says $5 billion of reconstruction money has had to be redirected to security. So one of the reasons why there isn't enough money to complete all the projects that were planned is that we have to spend a lot of money on security because of the insurgency. Are insurgents also blowing up or in other ways destroying projects that have either been completed or been partially completed?
Yes, it's been a continuing problem for over a year. Good example is the Northern Pipeline. We have a couple of inspections that we completed, or three, in this latest report about that pipeline, but it has been beset with attacks over the last 12 months, and that has naturally impeded both the flow of oil, affected income, the national income for Iraq, and made the cost of reconstruction higher.
Before reconstruction started, before the actual invasion of Iraq, projections were that oil revenues would be able to pay for a lot of the post-war reconstruction. Have there been any oil revenues yet that can help pay for reconstruction?
Yes, there have. I mean, there is a steady pace of oil exporting, but it's been hampered by a number of problems. First, smuggling. The fact that there are substantial subsidies for fuels in Iraq has caused a black market for the illegal smuggling of oil products out of Iraq. Second, the attacks on the pipeline have impeded exports. And although the price of oil has gone up and added revenue to Iraq, the attacks on the pipelines have reduced export, and so essentially the total income in oil for Iraq has remained steady over the last quarter.
Now, your office is investigating theft, corruption, bribery, kickbacks. Can you give us an overview of how that picture looks right now?
Yes. We have made substantial progress over this last quarter on a variety of cases. I can't go into their details because there's a grand jury impaneled, and the information from that grand jury is confidential. But what I can tell you is that we have an organization called the Special Investigative Task Force for Iraq Reconstruction, SPITFIRE, that is composed of Immigration and Customs Enforcement from the Department of Homeland Security, the Internal Revenue Service, the Department of State Inspector General, and the Department of Justice. And in pooling our resources, we have made substantial progress in accumulating evidence on a variety of cases involving fraud and bribery. I expect very soon to be prepared to make some announcements on the specifics about those cases.
Now, is this investigating fraud and bribery on the part of contractors in Iraq? Like, who are you looking at?
Yes, U.S. personnel in Iraq, contractors and government.
Are there things about Iraq that make it a kind of fertile climate for bribery and corruption and fraud?
Yes, there was. It's a cash environment. Millions, hundreds of millions of dollars in cash being transferred in Iraq since CPA took over. The Coalition Provisional Authority was in charge of managing the development fund for Iraq. After the war, there was simply no electronic funds transfer capacity, and that means virtually every transaction, all the payment of salaries, the payment of on governmental budgets, was done in cash. And simply having that much cash around, I think, led to some wrongful conduct, and we are charged with identifying those who engaged in criminal conduct and bringing them to justice.
I think there was one business transaction involving $120 million in cash, and $96 million of those dollars actually went missing. How do you track down amounts of cash, like volumes of, how do you track down that much cash?
Well, actually, you're referring to our audit of the South Central CPA regional office in Hilla. And that has certainly been a financial disaster zone, if you will. We've done five audits in that area. In that particular audit, we concluded that there was $96 million for which there was inadequate documentation for the use of the funds. Actual lost dollars was $7 million, but we have investigations going on related to that. And in our latest report, we looked at two projects that were supposed to be funded with that money. The Deputy Secretary of Defense said, well, I understand that there was no accountability on this money, but go out and see if we got anything for the dollars that were actually spent, notwithstanding the lack of proper paperwork. And we did. We looked at the Karbala Library, and we looked at the Babylon Police Academy, and they were both severely deficient, failed to meet specifications, and grant dollars and contract dollars were missing.
Now, I think it was in your July report, you urged the government to withhold almost $90 million in payments to Halliburton because of problems with Halliburton's cost reporting. You said that the cost reporting was so problematic, your office couldn't perform a credible audit. What were the problems you were running into?
Well, it has been a problem that Kellogg Brown and Root had for over a year.
And I should say Kellogg Brown and Root is a subsidiary of Halliburton, and they are the subcontractor to the military to provide certain services like food and cleaning?
That's right. They have what's called the log cap contract, and that's to provide life support to the military. We are not looking at those issues. We've been looking at Kellogg Brown and Root for a while, and we've had concerns about them. We've done several audits. We did an audit of how they manage property, both in Baghdad and Kuwait during the Coalition Provisional Authorities period. We've looked at how they managed the task order that provided life support to the Coalition Provisional Authority. And in each of those audits, we found serious deficiencies. The Project and Contracting Office, which is in charge of the oversight of the oil contracts that Kellogg Brown and Root has, also had serious problems with the cost accounting, the simply how KBR kept their books and put them under a cure notice last December. And that simply means that they were severely deficient. They needed to bring their cost accounting up to minimum standards, or they were in danger of losing the contract. That cure notice stayed in place until June, when it was finally lifted. During my ninth trip to Baghdad in August, I addressed this issue with the managers at the Project and Contracting Office, and they said that those issues had mostly been resolved, but there were still some other problems with respect to Kellogg Brown and Root.
Are the problems that you're finding with Kellogg Brown and Root pretty standard problems that you might find in a situation like this, or does it seem exceptional to you?
I think this is an extremely difficult environment to operate in, so it's hard to say in a case like this, since this is sui generis. This is a situation of trying to rebuild an oil industry in a war zone. And so that is an obstacle that simply we haven't experienced elsewhere. But nevertheless, I'm concerned that certain required standards of cost reporting and execution are not being met by Kellogg Brown and Root, and that they need to bring their performance up. And it's not just me. It's me visiting with the managers, the U.S. managers at the Project and Contracting Office in Baghdad. They've had these concerns for most of this year as well.
I recently interviewed a reporter from the Chicago Tribune named Cam Simpson, who wrote an investigative series in the Tribune saying that KBR is, Kellogg Brown and Root, is leaving the hiring of foreign workers, this is mostly unskilled foreign workers, to Middle Eastern subcontractors who use fraud and coercion to lure unsuspecting workers to Iraq, and that these workers are sometimes told they're going to work in a swank hotel in Jordan, but instead they end up in Iraq. And several of the workers from Nepal who were executed in Iraq by terrorists were in this position. And also these workers, in order to get the job, have to pay a middleman, a broker, and they end up going deep into debt just to pay the broker to get the job. And then they become the equivalent of an indentured worker. They have to work just to pay back the debt that they have, and they can't leave the job even if they want to. Have you heard anything like this?
Yes, I have, and I addressed it last year with the Defense Contract Management Agency, which is in charge of overseeing Kellogg Brown and Root's operations under the LOGCAP contract. LOGCAP is the life support contract that the U.S. government issues to support overseas logistics for the military. We had similar complaints come in over our hotline, and I went with my inspectors to meet with the DCMA head and urged him to address them with KBR, and he said he would. We did see some responsiveness, some agreement to change the way of doing business, but I still think that the issue is there, and that more work needs to be done.
My guest is Stuart Bowen, the Special Inspector General for Iraq Reconstruction. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Stuart Bowen, the Special Inspector General for Iraq Reconstruction. He oversees the auditing of the reconstruction and investigates American involvement in fraud, waste, bribery, and kickbacks in Iraq. What are some of the projects that have been completed and that are functioning in Iraq that you think are making significant improvements in the life of Iraqis?
Good question. We have been out across Iraq, my inspectors have, over the last 6 months visiting projects. And we visited five electrical substations down in Basra, and they are very well constructed. They're not fully integrated into the grid yet, and we identified that problem, and it's being solved. But it's quality workmanship. There's a healthcare facility that we looked at this last quarter that is in good shape. There were some minor problems with the concrete beams, but overall it's a good project. We've done three inspections of the Al-Fatah pipeline crossing in northern Iraq, and while it's still early in construction, it looks like that integrated oil pipeline system is going to greatly benefit Iraq. And as an example of how SIGR has been able to help program success, our engineers looked at the river crossing tie-in and made a suggestion of a modification that will perhaps increase the flow of oil from that location by over 50%, resulting in millions of dollars in additional revenue for Iraq.
You've made how many trips to Iraq?
I'll be leaving on my 10th trip at the end of this week.
Can you share with us one of the most interesting experiences you've had in Iraq?
Yes. Well, in December, when I was leaving, it's very cold there, and I was sitting in the back of a C-130 strapped into the hanging jump seats. It was night. And we took off around 8 o'clock. And normally when you leave, you spiral out. What that means is that the pilot will corkscrew his ascent in order to avoid any ground fire. Well, we started to go into our corkscrew, and suddenly I realized this was different. He went into a left bank that was pulling at least 2 Gs, and suddenly out the rear of the aircraft, I saw this bright light, and I realized he'd fired all of his flares. And I could see out the back window for miles. It was so bright. And I knew that something wrong had happened and that we perhaps had taken a shot. And indeed, when we landed, I talked to the loadmaster, and he confirmed that there had been a discharge of a handheld SAM in our direction, but it had followed the flares. So that, you know, I've called what we do extreme auditing, because it is a dangerous place to work, and you know, it's not just that experience. It's also been we've had rockets that with some regularity fall in the vicinity of where we work, and that we work right there on the Tigris, and the Republican Palace. It's a massive structure filled with Italian marble designs, beautiful artwork, but it is also exposed to rocket attacks. And indeed, in January, a rocket came through the roof and impacted the room immediately adjacent to where my auditors were working, and tragically, two project and contracting office employees were killed.
Has being in this job meant, you know, like losing certain friends, because you have to give the facts, and sometimes the facts don't look that appealing in terms of projects that aren't getting completed, the amount of money that we have to spend on security, insurgents destroying projects that are completed or half completed, and you have to start them all over again. I mean, the news isn't always good news.
Mm-hmm. And well, you're right. Being an inspector general is not a great way to win friends and influence people, per se. I wouldn't say I've lost friends in the course of this. It's simply carrying out a mission that I've been assigned to do. And as I said, when I started this job, that I would let my audits and investigations speak for themselves, and we would tell the good and the bad news just as we found it, and that's what we've done. And there's been a lot of both. And I think as we move in then to the next phase of supporting Iraqis as they rebuild the rest of their infrastructure, that we can look for a continuation of the steady progress that I've begun to see over the last two quarters.
When Reconstruction efforts were projected, I don't think anyone thought that the Reconstruction would be taking place while Iraq was still a war zone, while there was a powerful insurgency. But that, in fact, is what's happened. Are there instances in which there's a level of almost futility in reconstructing in the middle of a war zone, knowing that insurgents are going to target some of the Reconstruction efforts?
Perhaps with some projects there has been a frustration. The Northern Pipeline that I've talked about several times is one of those. But also let me say that Iraq has 18 provinces. It's really, the insurgency is concentrated in four. There are large sections of the country that are relatively peaceful and where reconstruction has progressed unimpeded. But at the same time, there is danger, the threat of danger everywhere, and that pushes costs up and leads to delays.
Stuart Bowen, I want to thank you very much, and I wish you safe travels on your next trip to Iraq.
Terry, thank you. It's been a pleasure to be with you.
Stuart Bowen is the Special Inspector General for Iraq Reconstruction. His office released their seventh report to Congress earlier this week. You can find a link to that report on our website, freshair.npr.org. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Monique Nazareth, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Ian Chillog, Patty Leswing, Sam Brigger, and Lauren Krenzel. Sue Spolin directed the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. From Bantam Books, publisher of No True Glory, a frontline account of the battle for Fallujah by Bing West, co-author of The March Up. And from Entrepreneur Magazine, presenting its annual Young Millionaires issue, featuring millionaires under 40. The November issue is on newsstands now. This is NPR. National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, our TV critic David Bianculli hosts the show. He'll talk with the creator and executive producer of the TV series Arrested Development, Mitch Hurwitz. And he'll talk with a former regular on the show, Henry Winkler, who now stars in the new CBS series, Out of Practice. Join us for the next Fresh Air.